I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:32 p.m. Thursday, February 4th. We're meeting today in room 205 in the Butcher Room. We do have a quorum to do business. Today's members, committee members present today are Senator Reinbolt, Senator Hughes, Senator Begich, myself, Senator Wilson. We are expecting Senator Casella. Today we are going to continue with Senate Bill 56, the COVID-19 disaster extension sponsored by Senate Rules on behalf of the governor. My intent today is to let the department finish their presentation, hear invited testimony, and begin public testimony. Folks here to address the bill today are Commissioner Adam Crum, Department of Health and Social Services, Director Hedy Heidberg, the Division of Public Health, Department of Health and Social Services, Mike Coons, President of the MATSU Chapter of the Association of Mature American Alaskan Citizens, Jared Cushion, the President of CEO of the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association, Michael Bailey, the Deputy Director of Hope Community Colleges, and Ms. Renee Berner, the President and CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board. And we have a myriad of lifelines online for the for folks to talk with, and that's a long list here, but we'll quickly go through that. We have the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Zink, Deputy Commissioner Paul Nelson of Deputy of the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs, Director Brian Fisher, Operations Manager of Homeland Security, Emergency Management of the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. We have the OMB Director, Director Neil Steininger. I'm going to get that name right one day, Director. And we also have Director Chambers, Sarah Chambers from the Division of Corporations, Business, Professional Licensing of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and the Borough Chief of Lisa Puritan of Criminal Records, from the Department of Public Safety. With that, we'll invite Commissioner Crum and Director Heidberg, whoever is going to start off with the presentation, to remember to place yourself on the record as you guys go in between presenters. And we have the wonderful Ms. Suzanne Cunningham, I believe, who's here to help advance slides when you are ready to begin. And I believe for the public and for folks, we are starting on slide 4. For committee members, just want to let folks know today we are going to allow the entire presentation to go forth, so we have time for that. Questions will come in after that for a period of time. We'll see how many people are online to testify, and then we're going to cut off committee members' questions to allow folks to testify from the public, because we want to make sure that they have the opportunity. They waited all time last Tuesday. I remember which day of the week we were here. To allow for questions for that, and then we'll allow that because we can always have more time for questions a little later. So with that, if you would like to begin, either Commissioner or Director Hedberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. I'd like to thank the committee members for your consideration of this bill, and also acknowledge the fact that none of us are happy to have to be here after a full year of the response having to address this, but we're going to present today and talk about why we need the available authorities in order to continue our response and to bring us across the finish line. So with this, what I'd like to do is actually introduce Brian Fisher, Incident Commander for the State at DMVA, and he's going to give a brief overview of the Alaska Disaster Act. So, Mr. Fisher?
Yes. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Fisher. I'm an operations manager at the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and currently serving as incident commander for the state's COVID-19 Unified Command. We're on the slide titled Overview of the Alaska Disaster Act. I'm not going to read the slide, but did want to share that the Alaska Disaster Act is really the laws that were put in place by the legislature to provide for the authorities and responsibilities of the whole of government in responding to any dangerous disasters, emergencies, catastrophes that may occur in the state and affect our citizens. So it really is the baseline statutory authority that we have moving forward to respond to emergencies. purpose of the Disaster Act is listed there. On the next slides, I'll talk a little bit more about some specific parts of the Act that are being utilized in the current disaster and through the proposed bill here. So next slide, please. Thank you. To answer a question that came out in the hearing on Tuesday, I'd like to jump right in and speak to the definition of a disaster. That's 2623-900, subsection E, for this particular event. And it really defines that a disaster means that there's the occurrence or imminent threat of widespread or severe damage. And in particular for this, reads an outbreak of disease or credible threat of an imminent outbreak of disease that the Commissioner of Health and Social Services certifies has a high probability of occurring. And I wanted to answer the question, the certification must be based on specific information received from a state, federal, or international agency or another source. And really, at the beginning of the pandemic and continuing through today, we utilize information that came out early on in the winter last year, specifically the World Health Organization on January 30th, designated that the SARS-CoV-2 and COVID outbreak was a public health emergency of international concern. So that was an international agency that we utilized to make that certification. Following that, the Secretary of Health and Human Services for the United States government declared a national public health emergency on January 31st. Moving forward, the World Health Organization declared a COVID-19, a global pandemic, on March 11th, and on April 9th, the President Trump did declare a major disaster for the state of Alaska as a result of this pandemic. So that certification based on credible information from those agencies is what we continue to use. We continue to receive lots of information from primarily the federal government, Health and Human Services, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on the characteristics and nature of this pandemic. Moving forward, Alaska Statute 2623-020C really is the section of the Act that allows the governor to declare a disaster when that certification is made. That particular citation also explicitly says that the legislature has the authority to extend the disaster beyond 30 days. So, hence why Bill 56 is in front of you today. I think a couple of the key points in 2623-020 that we wanted to highlight and we'll continue to talk about through the remainder of the presentation are 020 subsection E, which talks about the response and recovery aspects and specifically provides the authority for the deployment, use, and distribution of supplies, including medicine, and Alaska 2623-020G, which has provisions specifically to allocate or redistribute food, water, fuel, clothing, medicine, or supplies. And we are relying on those authorities today to make that happen for the response, particularly in the aspects of vaccine and therapeutics. I had another number of other issues that I wanted to raise within the Disaster Act itself. So Section 2623-060 and 140 really speak to the local authorities and responsibilities in law for local governments, that those statutes do say that our agency is there to serve local communities as they're responding, but it also provides specific responsibilities and authorities on local jurisdictions, as was mentioned by previous members of the committee on Tuesday, that, for example, municipalities have a responsibility and do have authorities to make their own emergency disaster declarations, to implement their own measures to respond to the outbreak. So as stated earlier, independent of the governor's declaration of disaster emergency, municipal governments in the state, political subdivisions do have that authority on their own. In addition, to answer a question that came up on Tuesday, to just confirm that 2623-025 addresses the responsibilities of the legislature and disasters, and subsection C of that statute does specifically say the legislature may terminate a disaster emergency at any time by law. So that clearly is available authorized in the statute for the legislature. some additional statutes that we have been utilizing through the entire response here and continue to look at are, in addition to the authorities in Section 2623.020G, subsection 1 there, is the governor's authority to waive and suspend regulations that may impede or hinder our ability to respond. So many of the items in the bill address those specific abilities to suspend regulations to allow us to continue to provide an effective response to the communities and the citizens throughout the state. There's additional statutory language that allows for what's called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, and that is an interstate compact with all the states in the nation to provide mutual aid support as needed. If we were to need additional resources from other states in the lower 48, in order to be able to do that, a disaster declaration needs to be in place according to those statutes to affect that mutual aid. I will say that the majority of the Disaster Act and the authorities for declaring a disaster really are time limited. So I know there's been conversation about that. And really, the Act is there, again, as the baseline statutes in place to allow us to temporarily make these changes to provide that for that effective response. Final thing I'd like to say is that there are additional statutes, 2623.020 F and 2605070, that speak to the governor's role and his authorities to utilize the National Guard in support of a declared emergency. And we are using the great men and women of the Alaska National Guard in the pandemic response and hope to continue to do that throughout this pandemic. Thank you for that, and I'll turn the next slides back over to Commissioner Crum.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. For the record, again, this is Commissioner Crum of Department of Health and Social Services. In recognition of the committee's time today and the desire to proceed to invited and public testimony, as well as to hear comments of the chairman and other members of the committee, and to proceed to a discussion of why an extension is being proposed, I would like to advance to slide 13 of the presentation. I am happy to answer questions pertaining to the slides we are skipping over at a time that the chairman deems appropriate to answer these questions, if there are any. If Mr. Chairman agrees, then we can move to slide 13, and I would like to turn this over to Director Hamburg to discuss.
Good afternoon. My name is Heidi Hedberg, for the record, and I am the Director of Public Health. And I would like to advance to slide 14. I'm going to share what the Public Health Emergency Authorities has allowed us to do, why we need to continue, and what will happen if we do not have one in place. When there is transmission of a new, very contagious, infectious disease in Alaska, immediate assistance to the public is needed to keep illness and death at bay. This assistance can only happen by declaring a public health emergency. What we know is that states that acted early and quickly, setting up testing sites, robust contact tracing processes, disseminate information quickly, responded timely to public concerns, expanded healthcare capacity, quickly standing up large mass vaccination sites, and remaining consistent by not letting the foot off the pedal, have kept lower case numbers, lower death rates, and lower hospitalizations versus other states that were slow to act. Without the ability to be nimble and respond to the imminent threats to Alaskans, our state would not be ranked as number one safest state based on lowest deaths, lowest hospitalizations, lowest case counts, and highest vaccination rates in the United States. We are also second in the nation for testing per capita. This will change if we don't have the ability to respond quickly to requests for support from the healthcare system and communities. One tool that the declaration allows is continued use of more efficient procurement processes. DHS's standard procurement process is to follow the invitation for bid or request for proposal process as outlined in Alaska Statute 36.30.110 and 36.30.210. This process can take between 30 days to 6 months, depending upon the complexities of the proposal. The public health emergency gives the authority to use emergency procurement, followed up with a competitive bid process for long-term contracts. This is critical when hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and communities do not have or have exhausted their resources and they're looking to the state for help. As you look over slide 14, and please pause and look at slide 14, it recognizes that DHSS would not have been able to accomplish all that we have done without a public health emergency. Emergency procurement followed with a competitive bid process for long-term contracts is what separates us from the other states. We acted quickly to contain the transmission of COVID. And the successes of this response are a direct result of the authorities within the disaster declaration. We need to continue to be nimble in our response so that we can continue to do the right thing now to prevent further spread of COVID. And while the nature of the response has changed over time, as we have built up response capabilities, the fact is it's still an emergency, and we must continue to act to protect the public health and safety of all Alaskans. So, you know, as I look at this list, I just want to highlight a couple of things. You know, this spring, when the hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and communities could not secure personal protective equipment, testing supplies, or hand sanitizer, they looked to the state to step in and respond. And as we see a year later, healthcare facilities are still experiencing some supply chain constraints due to the global impacts of COVID. Additionally, treatment options are continually being researched in both the outpatient and hospital settings. There has been one fully approved COVID-19 specific treatment option, which is remdesivir, and it's an antiviral medication used in a hospital setting for severe illness. And the FDA has issued two emergency use authorizations for two monoclonal antibodies that's used in outpatient settings to treat COVID within the first 10 days of diagnosis. The state does not prescribe treatment options, but does help allocate the scarce resources of monoclonal antibodies. And this disaster declaration provides the state with the tools to support allocation of scarce resources, such as medicine, to treat those infected and vaccinations. Last summer, before tour season kicked off, communities wanted assurance from the state that we were protecting Alaskans and preventing our healthcare system from being overwhelmed. Knowing that one of the main avenues COVID would use to enter Alaska was through travelers via airports, we quickly set up screening and testing at the airports that received flights from the lower 48. This could not have worked out without our amazing partnerships with communities and the emergency procurement, that we were able to successfully set up screening and testing at the 10 airports. And I just want to highlight that since June 6th, we've screened 471,884 travelers. We've tested 162,055 travelers at the airports, and we've identified 2,355 positive cases. And identifying those positive cases at the airport testing has allowed the state to curtail community transmission. This was instrumental in keeping Alaskans' positive cases counts low and the lowest in the country. As well, you know, when Alaskans want up-to-date information on what's happening in their community and in state, they look to DHSS to provide accurate and timely information, which is why we created the COVID case count dashboard and the vaccine dashboard so everyone can have access to the same information. We could not have stood up the dashboards as quickly as we did without the ability to secure contracts and hire additional staff. And then, you know, DHSS was overwhelmed last spring and continues to receive a lot of questions and inquiries about COVID. And so we partnered with the University of Alaska Center for Human Development to create a large virtual platform called Project Echoes to provide updates. And since March, we have had 362 echo sessions that covers 24 topic areas. These topic areas are in four broad categories of medical, community, education, and government. And when we drill down just a little bit, that was 66,419 attendees via Zoom and over 96,000 via Facebook. All sessions are recorded for those that are not able to attend the live session. And we have seen 37,419 views of recorded sessions. This is important because it provides a consolidated format to reach all Alaskans, regardless of where you live, to hear the latest science and evidence-based information. Please advance to slide 15. Alaska Statute 2623.020 gives DHSS the authority to allocate scarce resources, to rapidly engage in contracts to respond to new outbreaks, continue testing and sequencing of positive specimens. Sequencing positive specimens is critical to identifying when the variants enter Alaska so that we can notify Alaskans and understand the epidemiological impacts and respond accordingly. As we have seen in other countries, the variants can accelerate transmission and increase the severity of the disease, which is why we are focused on vaccinating our most vulnerable Alaskans first to reduce the severity of the disease and the transmission. In closing, I have 4 points. First, without the public health emergency, the state is extremely limited on how we respond to the pandemic, which is why it's required. Second, without the public health emergency, we're concerned about the ability to allocate scarce resources like vaccine and monoclonal antibodies. Third, without the public health emergency, there is no centralized management to allocate scarce resources, which jeopardizes the state vaccine administration framework. Fourth, without the public health emergency, communities that do not have local health powers will be left behind and limited with no support. Again, I want to restate the following. Without the ability to be nimble and respond to the imminent threats to Alaskans, our state would not be ranked as number one safest state based on lowest deaths, lowest hospitalizations, lowest case counts, and highest vaccination rates in the United States. We're also second in the nation, as I said, for testing per capita. This will change if we don't have the ability to respond quickly to requests for support from the healthcare system and communities. Passage of Senate Bill 56 is critical to continue to provide statewide response to COVID-19 to address the therapeutics and vaccinations in the coming months. This bill provides a time-limited extension to the public health emergency, which continues to be an imminent threat to the citizens of the state. I know that we are all exhausted from this virus. I know that I am. It's been a long year. And everyone has been impacted one way or another. But this extension is necessary to get Alaskans vaccinated and for the health and well-being of all Alaskans. Thank you. Back to you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Director Hedberg. I just want to say thank you to the committee, Mr. Chairman, for having us here today to present this case. Look forward to questions as the chairman deems appropriate, and looking forward to listening to the public testimony. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. I guess before we go into questions, part of the presentation we asked, I'm not sure who was going to be on the phone to answer this question for Deed, who wanted to talk about sort of the disaster declaration and what that means for them. Let me see if someone was on the line. Heidi Tesner, I believe, was going to answer and talk a little bit more.
Tishner.
Sorry. Thank you, Senator. Upon the question on what would happen with the carryover funding of the educational of the schools, would that be allowed for next year if without a disaster declaration?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can. Please continue.
Okay, perfect. For the record, my name is Heidi Tesner. I am the Director of Finance and Support Services with the Department of Education and Early Development. And as it is, the disaster, the waiver that was put in place under the current disaster declaration was for the fiscal year 2020 for the 2019-2020 school year. And so that's the year that just passed, since we are in fiscal year 2021 without a disaster declaration. The governor would not have the ability to temporarily suspend the 10% carryover limitation set out in statute. All
right. Thank you. And with that, Senator Begich, and then we'll go to Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is a thank you again, Commissioner Crum, for your testimony, and also to Director Hedberg. A couple of questions, and I just these are designed to just sort of clarify what I think I heard. And you've actually answered most of my questions by expressing how important the expedited procurement issues are for vaccinations. And I want to just be clear I heard that correctly. Without the your ability to take the up to, say, 100,000 vaccinations that may be available soon and get them to the public who wish to have them, you would be hampered in doing so without the expedited procurement. Is that correct? That the order provides. Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Begich. Through the chairman, procurement is essential for responding timely to supporting the healthcare community and the community at large. Vaccine allocation, we are very concerned that we don't have the authorities if the public health emergency goes away. There will also be significant constraints because we will not be able to distribute those logistically without expedited procurement.
Thank you for that. And I'm trying to keep the answer short, too, because if I can get through these real quick, then I won't be asking any more, Mr. Chairman. So let me go with the next, please, may I?
Yes, and for the committees, we're going to do questions until about 2:15. So after that, we're going to go on to public.
I do not intend to dominate the time. Please keep the answers short. You mentioned the authorization of the authority of other jurisdictions to do whatever they may choose to do right now. That only applies to home rule communities that have that power. And I'm suggesting proposing an amendment that would allow other communities to do their own, exercise their own authority within the pandemic. Is that something that you mentioned it twice in your testimony. Is that something that would be a problem for you? If there were such an amendment.
So through the chairman, Senator Begich, what we recognize is that there are very few communities with health powers, and these communities look to the state to provide coordination of resources and implementing and using mass vaccination sites. Director Brian Fisher can answer more specific questions.
That may have answered my question, Mr. Chairman. Let me just the last two I have here. Under the current orders, or so under the older orders, we had workers' compensation coverage for first responders. You've talked about in this testimony expedited licensing continuing. Would it be the intent or would it be contrary to the intent of the extension of the order if a workers' compensation protection extension was also provided consistent with SB 241?
Mr. Chair, this is for the record, Commissioner Crum. Is there somebody on the Department of Labor that can answer that question about workers' comp?
If not, I'll take that offline, and it can be sent to me, Mr. Chairman. And my last question is that if the bill has a retroactivity clause to February 13th, it makes an assumption that we might not get this done by February 13th. So that will imply a break in service before this order was validated. So it's a two-part question. Will screening and testing, such as described at the airport, stop if the order is not completed and approved by the legislature by that date? Or conversely, if it is completed perhaps by the end of February or early March when the House finally comes together, and it's retroactive, will there still have been a break in service there? I'm just trying to see if we're going to end up with a gap here, or will there be some level of authority to continue testing at airports, et cetera, while we wait for approval of an order? And that concerns me deeply, given the data you've presented and the actual economic impacts if we are no longer able to claim first in all these great categories of achievement.
For the record, this is Heidi Hedberg, Director of Public Health. Through the chair to Senator Bakage, right now our current contracts will cover us for the next couple of months, and so testing will continue at the airport. However, the health orders are tied to the public health emergency. When there is a gap, those health orders will have to change into possibly recommendations. And so we will see the impact during this gap of a public health emergency with less compliance with travelers either coming into Alaska or traveling out to our remote communities. And that is very concerning because, as I have just mentioned, we have been able to capture and identify 2,355 positive cases through that airport testing strategy, which has really helped us to contain and mitigate the spread of COVID.
Offline, Mr. Chairman, the retroactivity clause then creates potentially a problem, which we can discuss offline, but that is the issue of, if indeed it becomes a recommendation and then it passes in early March and it's and becomes retroactive to February 13th, there would be public members believing it was a recommendation who are now under our health mandate retroactively. So I just want to be able to make sure we do that legally and properly and right, and we can do that offline. But that's the issue that I'm bringing up there.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to start out just by thanking those of you at the department who really stepped up. I was pretty proud when in the national news in the last few weeks, Alaska was highlighted as far as our numbers and how well we were able to contain things, and I know it's been a stressful year, and I want you to know that. I also have great concern about our state. This morning there was news that the cruise industry is not going to be coming to Alaska. Our economy is at a place where it needs to be revitalized. We're not sure what's going to happen with the Biden administration when it comes to resource development. And so just as we've learned about the impact, for instance, on young people and other population groups, I'm actually concerned about our general mental, a collective state, emotional and mental health and our psyche as far as what's going to be happening in the year 2021. And so while I understand that you need certain tools to do what you need to do, I am wondering, because as I look at the list on slide 14, a lot of it has to do with having the funds to be able to do things, being able to procure things and distribute things. So if we were able to give you those specific tools without extending the actual date, I think that would be good for the psyche of our state to move on and starting to recover. For instance, the 10% carryover of the funding, you know, that is a statute we could specifically fix, and we could allow that the take care of that matter. Many of these other things I think we could specifically fix that you need as tools. So what I would like, and I don't expect an answer right now, it might be something they'd have to compile. When I look at page 14, to do those things and what Deed did, what laws, basically what laws would the executive branch be breaking if we didn't fix them in order for them to do any of these items without actually extending the emergency declaration date?
So I'm going to ask for if the commissioner could get to the committee or any of the other responsible folks online, maybe Neil Stein, OMB director, or just for the administration to provide a list to the committee of all the statutes and regulations that have been suspended or modified since the disaster and that are currently suspended now would be helpful for the entire legislative body I think that would be...
Could I have a quick follow-up?
Yes.
I just want to give an example. So one of the items on this list, which says the disaster statutes gave authority, it was to have a call center to help answer questions. I am guessing there's not a law to prevent you from having a call center as long as you had the funding. So some of these items I don't think are really, you're not really blocked by statute to do. So what I want to know are the particular statutes that would have to be changed in order for you to have the tools without the extension of the date.
Yes. Along with the regulations that have been suspended since the start and currently, and any other statutes that have been modified or been suspended since the beginning of the pandemic. Senator Hughes, any other questions? Okay. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got probably 100 questions, so I'll go as long as you allow me to. But first of all, I would like Dr. Zink, if you could state, have this type of mRNA vaccine been done before, or is this just an emergency use authorization? And I'd like you to discuss the trials back with COVID SARS-1 back in 2002 and 2005, and what panned out in those studies.
Through the chair, this is Dr. Zink. They were unmuting me, and I couldn't hear what specific thing you were asking me at the beginning. Can you please repeat your question?
First of all, the mRNA, is it a new type of vaccine, yes or no? So we can start there.
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, the mRNA vaccine, this one to COVID-19 is new, but this platform is not new and has been under investigation and been used for approximately 15 years.
Through the chair. So basically what I'm asking you, can you please discuss the studies with the mRNA vaccine in the past for COVID SARS-1 and what happened with those studies, those experimental, the animals that were in the study?
So, Senator Reinbold, through the chair, we have vaccinologists as well as immunologists on our team. I would be happy to provide additional information with you on that, but I am not an immunologist or vaccinologist. I am aware of those studies, but I don't have them at my fingertips right now and would like to provide that to you in writing.
Through the chair, can you just, you know what happened in those studies. Can you just state it on the record what happened with those studies? Senator, if you don't, I will.
Senator Reinbold, that will be provided as from Dr. Zink, she said in writing.
Okay. So I'd like your synopsis of what happened in those studies in 2002 and 2005. Well, I can tell you that those studies were stopped because the animals were dying. So I think it's very, very important. I think you know, and I think I am not an anti-vaxxer, but I'm concerned about this new type of vaccine that is out there, that they are only strictly under emergency use authorization. So I have the constitutional responsibility to help, as all of us senators do, for the health and public health of the Alaskans. And that's where my heart is. I want everybody to know. So yes or no, Dr. Zink, are you requiring informed consent as required by emergency use authorization for each and every vaccination, this brand new mRNA vaccination that's still, in my opinion, under trial? And I read till 2 a.m. last night about the Pfizer. Yes or no, are you requiring informed consent each and every time one of these quote-unquote vaccines is administered?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, everyone who's been administering vaccine is getting informed consent prior to administering the vaccine.
Mr. Okay. Chair, could I get an at ease?
Yes, at ease.
Thank you.
All right. Yes, now we're back on the record. And just remind folks, we have a couple more minutes before we will start an invited testimony.
Can I continue?
Yes.
Okay.
Cindy Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So regarding informed consent, you said those that are administering are getting informed consent. Is every patient that is receiving this vaccine getting informed consent?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, this is Dr. Zink. Our recommendation is that every provider who is administering vaccine give informed consent to every patient prior to getting vaccine.
Okay. Through the chair, have there been any adverse reactions in Alaska? And if so, can you please describe them? As you talked about the cases, you know, you're constantly posted the number of cases. Can you talk about the adverse reactions and if there has been any death with the mRNA vaccination, for either from Pfizer or Moderna, and if you can, you know, tell which one, that would be really, really helpful.
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, this is Dr. Zink again. So adverse reactions are not reported to the state. They're reported to the CDC and to the federal government via two different processes, the VAERS system as well as the VSAFE system. The VAERS system takes reports in that are required from clinicians, but patients can put in reports as well. The CDC and the FDA go through those reports and then contact the state if there are any concerns about adverse reactions and or deaths. To date, the state has received two cases where there's concern about adverse reaction, both anaphylactic type reaction that we've reviewed in combination with the CDC and have talked about publicly. There are many other reports within VAERS, but they have not found those to be causative or they're continuing to be under investigation. And to date, there are no deaths associated with the COVID-19 vaccine, Moderna or Pfizer, in the United States.
Last question.
Wow, that is amazing, because I'm certainly following COVID reactions online, and I'm also following VAERS. And I tell you, I think that's definitely contradicts things that I've definitely been following online. And I also have a physician that's looking into the VAERS data right now, so I would like the opportunity to bring him before the committee. What is your ultimate goal in regards to the vaccinations? You keep saying that the ultimate goal is to procurement and to get vaccines. One, I want to know if vaccines can be available any other way, or you know, if or will they still be available if this emergency, or is it just all about rushing and procurement? One, and number two, what's your ultimate goal? Is it herd immunity? And can you guarantee that you are getting immunity with these vaccinations and can confirm safety and efficacy?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, again, this is Dr. Ann Zink. We have looked through the data, and these vaccines have gone through all of the normal safety protocols that are happening for any vaccine, safety phase one, phase two, and phase three clinical trials. We continue to work closely with the FDA and CDC to monitor these. Our goal is to make sure that Alaskans who choose to get vaccinated have access to vaccine. And so we are trying to get a vaccine available to any Alaskan who chooses to get vaccinated.
And Dr. Zink, we're going to go to, I think Heidi Hedberg can answer the first part of that question in terms of what would happen if the disaster declaration is not in order in terms of vaccines distribution and priorities.
And then, Mr. Chairman, she avoided all the questions, the points, and so I would need to make sure that those get on record. You know, what's your ultimate goal? How many Alaskans have been? What happens to an Alaskan if they've had COVID and get a vaccination? And just to ensure, can she ensure safety and efficacy with these products?
All right, and I understand that, and if the doctor could provide possibly to the committee in writing those answers. But we do need to move on to invited testimony to make sure that we have enough time to get through the folks that are testifying. So we'll get an answer from Director Heiberg. If you can answer the question on what would happen if the emergency order goes away in terms of availability of the vaccines and priority of the vaccines.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, and I am the Director of Public Health. And so we need the authorities of the public health emergency to allocate scarce resources. Right now, the vaccines are a scarce resource. There is not sufficient vaccine to vaccinate everyone that in Alaska or the United States or the world that wants to be vaccinated. And so therefore, the federal government is allocating to each of the states' pro rata vaccine amount. It comes to the state. We need the authority from the public health emergency to allocate to the communities. Without that authority, we are in a very precarious situation when the public health emergency expires.
All right, thank you. And if possible, maybe that could also be given to the committee in a written statement of what sort of to answer Senator Begich's first question of what happens during the time if the disaster lapsed in terms of allocation, what's at risk during the lapse time, I think it would be prudent. At this time, we're going to go to Mike Coons, the president of the MATSU chapter, Mature American and Alaskan Citizens, to provide invited testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Wilson and committee members. My name is Mike Coons. I'm the president of the MATSU Chapter Association of Mature American Alaskan Citizens AMAC Action. I will be speaking for the majority of my members. In addition to speaking for AMAC Action, I am a commissioner on the Alaska Commission on Aging. I know that the commission is in support of all senior citizens of the state of Alaska by supporting this existing SB 56. We also have two other chapters, the Greater Anchorage and the Fairbanks chapter. I got approval from Cheryl LaFollette, Fairbanks, and Robert Coulter, Greater Anchorage, to state here that both chapters are in full support of SB 56. And that is the majority of over 500 chapter members. Also statewide, AMAC has over 7,800 concerned and strong mature citizens in the state, not to mention 2.3 million strong nationwide. The extension of the emergency powers of this that is requested by Governor Dunleavy in SB 56 will have a huge impact on the lives of all 142,000 plus seniors in the state of Alaska. This gives the governor and his administration the ability to not only get the vaccine, be it Pfizer, Moderna, the up-and-coming Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, or others in the pipeline, but the means to get those vaccines to the citizens of Alaska, and in my opinion, the most important of all Alaskans, those mature Alaskans that want to regain our freedoms by having the choice to get our choice of vaccines, then be able to be out in the community and society. We've been told when the President of the United States on down that this virus was the most deadly to seniors and to those with other medical issues that weaken the immunity of the person. We were told to hunker down for our families to protect their parents and grandparents. This was done by those family members using social distancing, which meant no interaction with their parents, grandparents, and society as a whole. We were told to wear masks, then not to, now to wear two. We were asked to do a lot of things by our leaders, from the president to Governor Dunleavy to Dr. Zink and so many others. Repeat, asked, not mandated, like those in New York, California, New Jersey, Anchorage, et cetera, have done and still are doing. Sadly, some of those things were not based on solid science, and sadly, over this past year, have been moving targets. However, our leaders did the best they could based on the best information they were given. We can play 2020 hindsight all day, but by and large, President Trump, the governors like Governor Dunleavy, known from South Dakota, the status of Florida, et cetera, took not only the information, but ensured that the freedoms of our people were protected as much as possible, and any restrictions versus mandates were as little and short-lasting as possible. We know the direction of this new president, and it is not about freedom or freedom of choice. What with the direction of this new president, a governor that values our freedoms is needed even more. Look at what SB 56 does. It continues reducing the procurement time for the much-needed logistical items to get the vaccine out. The ability to have mass vaccinations throughout the state, such as the most recent in Anchorage and Palmer, would not have been possible. Without it, it is even questionable if we can continue getting the vaccine from the federal government, much less in the quantities needed versus getting the vaccine from the federal government, much those in the lower 48 that would get the vaccines over our citizens. We cannot forget that the ability to get the therapeutics would be greatly impacted. Look at the lower 48. The media reports that several states like California and New York don't have enough beds. What is not being reported is that this is because they do not get out the much needed therapeutics to those hospitals. The state of Alaska does. Mm-hmm. Therapeutics are one of the major reasons we have such low death rates and short-term hospitalizations. One of the major ones has had a huge impact on especially seniors not being admitted to the hospital, remdesivir, which is being used in a way that people, once they are positive with the virus, can get an infusion and not need a hospital bed. In answer to Senator Reinbold on hydroxychloroquine, never heard of the other drug that she talked about, that has been available to my doctor since day one and is being used by doctors and patients that want it. I've talked to my doctor about that. He can get it with no problem.
Mr. Koontz, if you could wrap up your comments.
I'm almost done, sir. Okay. All that capability and more will be lost if SB 56 is not passed. Not to mention the rules and regulations that have been suspended in so many cases we now see that we are not needed. Senator Reinbold was chair of the committee to review rules and regulations and repeal them. If she had the knowledge that we now have as to the wastefulness of those rules, she could have had a greater impact on all our freedoms years ago. The time frame of this...
We try not to have enough decorum to talk to members directly in that manner. Just want to...
I'm sorry. I didn't realize that was... I was answering the question. Okay. The time frame of this bill is so that if unforeseen things come up, the governor has the ability to use the tools to ensure that we are protected without denying freedoms. As we all hope and expect, the vaccine, the therapeutics, the number of those already infected and now well, will drive the herd immunity levels to that 70% goal, and thus the governor may very well have the ability to end these emergency powers far sooner than September. This is not a means of denying our liberties and freedoms. Far from it. It is a reasoned approach to work a problem with the least impact on our freedoms, liberties, our economy, and our very mental health as Alaskans. Alaska need not be like the lower 48, or sadly even like Anchorage, to rid ourselves of this virus. Alaska, all of Alaska, can show the lower 48 and the world that we have the means and the determination to do this right. Please vote yes on SB 56.
All right. Thank you.
And I'll take any questions you want to ask me, please.
Due to our time constraints, we're going to not take questions from our invited testifiers today.
Mr. Chairman, can I clarify some things you put on the record about me?
We'll do that.
I just think out of defense of myself.
Yeah, take an Addy, sir.
He came directly at me.
Going back, our next invited testifier is Jared Cushion. Mr. Cushion, if you could expedite your testimony, you may begin when ready. To state your title.
Yep. Testify today, and yes, I will go as fast as I can here. For the record, my name is Jared Cushion, and I am the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Alaska's hospitals and nursing homes strongly support Senate Bill 56. Let me start by answering a question that was asked on Tuesday and again today. Yes, we do need an emergency declaration in place. And no, while legislation can cover some provisions in Senate Bill 56, the declaration itself is vital for healthcare resources and flexibilities provided at the federal level. Before I detail precisely what is at stake, and I will be brief, I would like to highlight some of the most stressful moments Alaska healthcare providers have experienced over the last year. We experienced a glove shortage the week of October 12th. We had a healthcare system in the field with less than a two-week supply of gloves on hand and nearly ran out trying to keep up with demand. That same week in October, we had an assisted living facility in Anchorage with no staff available to work. We had rapid coordination with the state. We're faced with an impossible scenario. Do we pull staff from another stress facility, or do all the residents go to the hospital, the place of last resort? The week of November 13th, we had over 530 caregivers out statewide. I had a hospital CEO with 30-plus years of experience call and tell me they just have had the hardest day of their career managing patients with the influx of COVID admissions and staff out. On December 4th, 2 months to the day, we had our peak day for COVID patients in a hospital. We had 150 COVID patients, 117 of which were in Anchorage and the MAPSU. On that day, we were down to 5 ICU beds, 5 in our biggest population center. Both MAPSU Regional and Alaska Regional had 0 beds open. That same week, we saw a patient transferred from rural Alaska to Fairbanks. This type of transfer is unheard of, and it happened because our system was at its highest stress point. By the numbers, we are certainly better today than November, and I get that. But COVID is still here. So why do we need a declaration and not just legislation? Early in the pandemic, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued 125 blanket waivers for 32 categories of healthcare services and provider types. These waivers set aside or waive specific federal requirements for operational flexibility. Here is our concern. At least 20 of the waivers are only valid if they are, quote, not inconsistent with a state's emergency preparedness or pandemic plan. We believe if the state no longer formally recognizes a public health disaster emergency, then the blanket waivers would be, quote, inconsistent with Alaska's pandemic plan and be void. Simply put, there would be no longer an emergency for which a plan is required. I'll give you a couple examples and then end my testimony. If we lose the federal blanket waivers, the consequences will be real and they will be significant. There would be no waiver of provisions of the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. Here's an example. We have an emergency room with safety protocols that if patients show up with flu-like symptoms to the ED, they wait in their cars so they can be safely screened and triaged without exposing other patient populations. This would end. There'd be no waiver of environment of care standards. That's a term of art for hospitals. For example, we have an alternate care site with 27 hard beds in place that is active today. The Alaska Airline Center is another alternate care site that is active for infusion therapy and vaccination. These would close. We have a hospital that constructed temporary walls around a COVID unit, altered entrances and egresses, has power supplies and cords in place. All of these would be federal violations without the waivers being in place. On another note, without a declaration, we presumably lose support from the National Guard. Other states use the National Guard for vaccine distribution. When Alaska gets larger supplies in the coming months, we may need the National Guard to speed up vaccination. That is not possible without a declaration. In closing, from Alaska's hospitals and nursing homes, we need an emergency declaration in place. This is an issue of access to federal resources and flexibilities and certainty for us. It is not about mandates. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 56.
Thank you. Our next person to testify is Michael Bailey, Deputy Executive Director of Hope Community Colleges. Mr. Bailey, if you can make your comments quick and brief.
Just a quick point, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. My name is Michael Bailey.
Just a moment. Mr. Bailey.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just a quick moment. At ease.
Are we able to?
Back on the record, Mr. Bailey, please continue.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Michael Bailey. I currently serve as the Deputy Executive of Hope Community Resources and also serve on the board of the Alaska Association on Developmental Disabilities, which represents home and community-based providers serving vulnerable Alaskans. We all hoped that the pandemic would be over by now, but it's not. And I want to go on record as appreciating the guidance and leadership of the Department of Health and Social Services, so Alaska has fared better than most other states in the country. Also, thanks to Governor Dunleavy for listening to DHSS and leveraging his emergency declaration powers only to the extent necessary to respond to the measures that Director Heidberg described earlier in flattening the curve, allowing local community leaders to determine the mitigation measures to be customized to be their demographics, and to maintain some hospital capacity, even though it got very, very low. As we, as home and community-based providers, went into this pandemic a year ago, we were braced for 40% mortality rates that had been seen in the lower 48, and worked closely with the hospital associations and the state to assure that our frontline workers were considered key and essential to mitigating the more devastating effects that could have been expected in Alaska. And from that perspective, time is of the essence. And we regard this bill, SB 76, as a vehicle to address provider concerns for the welfare and safety of Alaskans if these current emergency declaration expires on February 14th without prompt legislative action. Even though vaccination efforts have begun and Alaska leads the nation in per capita vaccinations, it's essential that this momentum is perpetuated into and throughout the summer months to regenerate seasonal economic activities. Currently, HOPE has got about 25% of its employees vaccinated with more clinics planned, and we need to keep that momentum. I also want to mention that my prior employment was with Trident Seafoods and worked in Acatan for many years, and that currently, as you've seen in the news, has 20% of its workforce offline, and we haven't even started the summer season. It also represents a risk to the local villages, many of whom I know, and just concern for the economics of the state as well, and I believe that this bill will help serve both. Service providers who are already facing workforce shortages have also endured an additional disruption of their workforce availability. Up to 15% at any time can be quarantined, put on off work while they wait for test results so that they're not introducing risk. At HOPE, we've got a count of over 1,600 employees and recipients who have been quarantined in the past year, many of them repeated times, just to bring about some safety measures. Just want to reiterate that only the flexibilities that have been available through public health emergency declarations providing alternative service delivery modalities, telehealth, telemedicine, regulatory extensions related to professional and occupational licensing, and travel considerations are necessary to protect our native communities and local communities have allowed our service providers to remain as active partners in the statewide efforts. While telemedicine has a lot of benefit, and as some of our own data suggests that two-thirds of the telemedicine is actually behavioral health related, there are other nursing care coordination that requires some face-to-face visits that have only been possible through some of the electronic means. Mr. Cosin mentioned some of the blanket waivers specific to our field. The Appendix K waivers have been approved by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they're critical to maintaining those essential supports. They're closely linked and tied to the state declarations as well, and we need those to be extended as well. So the partnership between the federal declaration and the state declaration is essential. AADD is planning to submit requests to the state of Alaska in the near future for some of the flexibility to be continued beyond the pandemic because the effectiveness and efficiencies of these have been learned. The AADD has a membership of 60 providers with over 4,000 vulnerable Alaskans who, if they had to be crushed and put into the hospital system, would totally overwhelm it, as you've already heard. And so we need to continue the current strategies until we can get further through this. We believe that this act is essential for our state to recover its freedoms and economy.
Mr. Bailey, we're going to move on here. I'm sorry to cut you off there. We're a little over time there.
Support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know a lot of folks I see online have already submitted written comments as well. So if you just want to refer to those in your packets, we have those, the committee members have those comments, but we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. We're going to allow 2 minutes for each presenter. First, we have Mr. Niels Andreasen from Alaska Municipal League. If everyone can state their name and affiliation, and you may begin when ready.
Hi, thank you. For the record, this is Niels Andreasen. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, representing 165 cities and boroughs across Alaska, cities and boroughs that have played a fundamental role in supporting the state throughout this disaster response, both on the public health emergency side and the economic crisis. And we're in full support of extending the disaster declaration. And you know, essential to this is the implementation of the Alaska Disaster Act, which provides all the necessary statutory language to address the concerns that have been raised by so many. I want to focus just on a few things that we lose or that we're concerned about losing within this process. First, we may lose dozens of local declarations for those whose emergency ordinances were linked to the states, and either they expire completely or that they need to be amended. And that's roughly two-thirds of all local governments who implemented or adopted emergency ordinances. We lose the state's ability to waive procurement regs, again, which is allowed under current statutory guidance within the Disaster Act. We lose the state's ability to send strike teams out to many of our members, to high-risk communities where there are dangerous spikes that have been occurring within the pandemic, and for those communities that don't have public health powers or capacity to respond. We lose the state's ability to organize mass vaccination clinics, like we've seen organized just recently across the state. We lose the non-congregate sheltering contracts to some extent that need to be then applied through and worked out with the department, and that will affect a number of our members. We lose the preemption of local government authority, and you know, there's potentially an ad hoc approach to travel restrictions or to establishment of new critical infrastructure guidelines. We lose the ability for the state to establish vaccination delivery tiers in an open process that may leave out our most vulnerable.
If you could wrap up your comments, your time is over.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Lisa Morey on the Alaska Commission on Aging. You may begin your testimony when you're ready.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lisa Morley. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Aging, and I wanted to testify that the Alaska Commission on Aging is in support of extending the disaster declaration in SB 56. Individuals 65 and over are at the highest risk for being diagnosed with COVID and make up 80% of the fatalities. The passing of this bill will allow for the Department of Health and Social Services to continue interventions allowed by this disaster declaration that will ultimately save lives and help prevent illness for more individuals in Alaska seniors. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Dr. Ryan McGann.
Hi, thank you. My name is Ryan McGann. I'm a pulmonary and critical care physician. I also have a master's degree in public health. I work at Providence Alaska Medical Center as well as Matsu Regional Medical Center, and I was calling in support of Senate Bill 56. This has been completely unlike anything that I've experienced in over 20 years of pulmonary and critical care medicine. As has already been alluded to, December in particular was a nightmare. I am grateful that we here in South Central are doing better now, but we still have active outbreaks in Western Alaska. There are new variants of coronavirus circulating. This is not the time to let our eye off the ball. And, you know, the governor has been extremely restricted in his use of these emergency powers. I think that there is no question that they need to be extended through the end of the summer. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Abner Hogue.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Abner Hogue. I'm here today in my capacity as the emergency manager and incident commander for COVID response for the city of Ketchikan and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. In addition, I'm the current president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I serve on the State Emergency Response Committee. I'm a co-chair on the Local Emergency Planning Committee Association, and until my term expired in November of 2020, I served 8 years as a member and previous chair of the Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services. I'm calling to express my support for Senate Bill 56, extending the governor's declaration of disaster emergency. This relief is important. COVID is not the flu. Without going into a lot of data, I can tell you that it appears that COVID is roughly 3 to 6 times more deadly than annual flu. Alaska data indicates that 253 deaths due to COVID compared to roughly 60 to 70 in a normal flu season. Spread is more aggressive than the flu, symptoms are generally worse, and the infectious period and timing are longer. This has caused huge stress on our healthcare system and supply chain, and the outstanding work of DHS and EM and DHSS and the resources provided as a result of this and previous disaster declarations issued by the governor have provided significant support for local governments. We've used this in responding in various different ways, from testing to PPE support, and many of the other areas discussed by the Director of Public Health and the State Incident Commander. As we continue forward, COVID is an ongoing disaster emergency. It is not over, and testing and additional support will still be needed by your local communities. So we appreciate your support in passing Senate Bill 56. It's critical to the ongoing success of Alaska COVID response. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Next, we have Katie Boats. Katie, may begin your testimony when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Honorable Committee. My name is Katie Boats, and I am a concerned constituent of Juneau, Alaska, speaking on behalf of myself. I have heard the many testimonies before, and last week and this week's committee meetings, and I just want to make one point for each of you guys to consider health-wise. There are many other committees that I will be speaking on. I am extremely concerned about COVID-19. I am extremely frustrated. I have major depression disorder, and anything that relating to mandates for health personnel relating to COVID-19 is playing a huge effect on my mental health. My therapist have expressed deep concerns to me on various aspects of the past 10 months when different mandates and different health different health mandates been issued, or as they say, barked to the people of Alaska. But I wanted to allow the Health and Social Services Committees to know something that I have done research and many other constituents around the state, not just Juneau, but around the state, also share concerns about. Whether or not it is the governor's, Dr. Crum, or Dr. Zink's intention for the health mandates, there has been an underlying meaning to the people of Alaska, such as wearing the mask mandate is just shutting our mouth, silencing the people of Alaska into submission, washing our hands, washing away the governor's guilt, and not being held accountable. It is clear that the administration wants us to believe that they are untestable and not being held accountable for any mandates that is unconstitutional.
Hey, Ms. Bolt, your 2 minutes.
Separating 6 feet apart.
Yes, Ms. Bolt, your 2 minutes are up. Can you wrap up your testimony, please?
I guess there are many more of health things that have been issued that I would love to share, and I will submit in written testimonies, but there are hidden messages beneath these health mandates for you guys to see. Thank you.
Thank you. And for everyone listening online, following along, a testimony can be submitted to our Senate email address here for the Senate Health Committee, and that is shss@akleg.gov. Again, that is shss@akleg.gov. Our next person to testify is Jane Andreen. Jane, if you can state your name for the record and your affiliation, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Jane Andreen. I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Public Health Association, and I live in Douglas, Alaska. This pandemic emerged at a time when our public health system was at a deficit. Due to budget cuts over the last few years, prior years, we had lost about 20% of our public health nursing staff, and approximately 25% of our public health centers have been closed down. What has happened since then is that the state of Alaska and the Department of Health and Social Service has been able to very quickly build back up the capacity and the numbers that we need. It's important that we acknowledge that this pandemic is far from over. Just when we start to see a light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines being rolled out, we see new variants coming out that could be more deadly, more infectious, and continue to impact our health and well-being. The state of Alaska needs to have more than a 30-day to 30-day type of response. We have done well with the statewide travel restrictions, but a piecemeal approach is going to impact the effectiveness and the comprehensive approach that Alaska is going to be able to take. In case you can't tell, the Alaska Public Health Association does support Senate Bill 56. The state, as you have heard, has been able to build up the necessary workforce. We've been able to rank highly across the state for the way we've been able to respond for the health and well-being of our citizens. Just as, oh, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Okay. One of the things that we would like to see is for the governor to issue even stronger mandates than what he has done. We would like to see a mask mandate across the state. But since that has not happened, we have strong support and commend the Department of Health and Social Services for the excellent support and guidance that they have given to communities who have then been able to act in the best interests of their residents. I would like to see Senate Bill 56 passed and for continued support for Alaska's response to the COVID-19. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Renee Boner. All right, Renee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, we can. You may begin when you're ready.
Oh, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony in support of this crucial bill to extend the state's public health disaster emergency. For the record, my name is Brene Berner. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board. ANHB is the statewide voice servicing 229 federally recognized tribes for the Alaska tribal health system, a true system of care that is essential to Alaska's public health system. Alaska Natives are overrepresented in Alaska's hospitalization and death rates due to COVID-19. We make up 27.1% of all hospitalizations and 38.1% of all COVID-related deaths. That's more than a quarter of all Alaska hospitalizations and more than a third of all deaths. rural Alaska continues to be at particular risk of COVID-19 and its new variants due to factors such as crowded multi-generational homes, lack of running water and sanitation, and distance from advanced medical care requiring air travel to reach hospitals. The public health emergency has been critical in our response as we strive to protect our communities. Since the start of the public health emergency, we have seen a 303% increase of telehealth-related Medicaid services statewide, keeping providers and patients safe. The vast majority of this has been delivered through the Alaska Tribal Health System. What the public health emergency allows is that the PHC allows for rapid procurement and hiring for the response, essential elements when it comes to Alaska's vaccine distribution plan, and enabling us to set up POD mass vaccine clinics quickly and to put shots in arms. It provides flexibility in the delivery of health care through means such as telehealth that keeps our patients and providers safe and maximizing the workforce in Alaska through expedited and courtesy licensing, especially in fields where we are shorthanded and with health care providers and other regulatory flexibilities that are triggered by disaster emergency declaration, allowing providers to respond efficiently to the pandemic and other health care needs, which do not
wrap
end
up your comments, please.
Because there is a pandemic. Finally, only under the disaster provisions in Alaska Statute 2623.020G, subsection 10, can the governor allocate or redistribute food, water, fuel, clothing, medicine, or supplies, which includes the scarce vaccine allocations and therapeutics being used to treat COVID-19.
We're
going to
move on to our next person here to testify. Our next person is Amber Glasser.
Hi. Thank you so much. My name is Amber Glasser, and I just want to urge a no vote. I've been a longtime resident of Anchorage. I'm in District 18I. And the sooner the state is not in an emergency, the sooner Anchorage will be out of their state of emergency. You know, I've been in the hospitality industry for 22 years, and I started at Lucky Wishbone, and I've been at Simon & Seaforth's for the last 12 years. I'm currently furloughed because of this pandemic, and so many of my friends, these are small business owners, restaurant owners, servers, bartenders, bussers, dishwashers, chefs, hotel workers, the local breweries, and so many others. We're all really struggling. We might have money in our bank account, and we might have a roof over our head, but for how long? I don't want to speak for everyone, but I know that a lot of people just want the right to choose and want the right to be open all the way, with masks being encouraged, not forced. I don't want to take up too much time, but I do want to mention Sarah Price. She is an Eagle River High School student, and I just want to applaud her. I would like to echo what she has been saying for months and echo her testimony from yesterday's February 3rd, 2021, to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So bravo, Sarah. Thank you and well done. I would also like to thank Senator Laura Reinbold for sharing our thoughts and truly being a public servant and not just a politician. I would like to echo what you've been saying in these meetings. And I'd also just like to mention, for the last 10 months, I've been learning how local and state government works. So please bear with me. It's definitely been a crash course. And if Florida can be open, if South Dakota can do it, why can't Alaska do it? Alaska's made of the best and most resilient people I've ever met in my life. I'm proud to live here. And I know we can all come together and figure it out. I know we can keep our most vulnerable safe while being open at the same time. I've learned so much about the
Ms.
people
Glasser,
in my community.
If you could wrap up your comments, your time is up.
And I want to thank everyone. You've all taught me so much in this short amount of time. And I just urge a no vote. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Next, we have Dean Cannon.
Hello there. My name is Dean Cannon. I urge a no vote on SB 56.
I'm an Alaskan. I represent no entity or organization that would benefit from these orders. Experts agree the best way to control the spread of COVID-19 is through travel restrictions, which is happening in Alaska right now. Alaska's natural advantage is the isolation, which enables it to restrict that travel. This is key to Alaska's reaction to COVID that we are hearing about today and on Tuesday. I was one of those positive cases at the airport. Thank God that testing is going on. What I am hearing is the reason of the extension of these orders is a lack of trust in the public, a lack of ability to govern without them, and too many entities losing money if they are not extended. COVID has revealed failures in our system. Emergency orders will not repair them. All that is required is a little hard work and the willingness to work together. The public are losing control over their lives and democracy under these emergency orders, and many of us feel too much authority is collecting in unelected bodies like the DHSS. One person talked earlier about the worst day of their career. People here are having the worst year of their lives. Do they need two? And I want to wrap up with, in 2017, the CDC warned of societal impacts of emergency orders like this and the long-term effects of restrictions during pandemics. Then the CDC lacked the data on societal impacts because there was no modern precedent like COVID. Now we have that data, and the societal impacts are obvious. And somebody mentioned on Tuesday about the Imperial College model. That was based on the Spanish flu, which is 10 times deadlier than COVID, and that model's author had to resign. The number of ICU beds in Anchorage changes every time I ask because they don't seem to include surge beds or COVID-dedicated beds. And one thing that really is important here is people are highly suggestible under prolonged stress. We've had a year of that stress, and a mental health crisis is inevitable, and I don't hear anybody from the DHSS talking about that. The capricious use of these emergency orders here in Anchorage is fracturing society, and it's destroying democratic norms. That should concern everybody. The DHSS, God bless them, but they appear to be in a professional competition with themselves and with other states for prestige.
If you could wrap up your comments, your time has ended.
Last word, a massive gap is growing between the governed and the government here in Alaska. It's just time to put these orders back in the drawer, resume democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. This time we're going to close public testimony. Folks, if you would like to submit your testimony, please go ahead and do so in writing to the HESS committee at shss.akleg.gov.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Was there anybody else online to testify?
Yes, we have some folks that are still, but we are out of time for today for the committee.
So close to, and, but we're going to extend it on Friday or next Tuesday?
That is not the right now, no.
So all these people that have been waiting to testify, they were all invited basically for the side of pro, but all the other people, they're not going to get an opportunity to testify?
At this time, we are closing public testimony on this bill, and that is people can still go ahead and submit written testimony. And written testimony can be given as part of the record to at our Senate HESS email address. At ease. So we're back on the record. I just want to thank the folks that have been holding online for now the second day. If you've been waiting to get your time in to testify, we're going to reopen public testimony again on our next date, which is February 9th, Tuesday. My office will accept amendments for this bill until close of business Monday, February 8th, is our new time frame for amendments. Please get those in to Ledge Legal to do that. And closing comments, Senator Reinbold.
On in regards to what?
I bet you may say that you have closing comments.
Well, one, you're doing mixed messages. I had lots of closing comments in regards to what Mike's Coons or whatever.
You had an opportunity that we let open for closing comments to make comments that you stated that you really wanted to make.
At 3:05, I think I'll pass. I asked to make them at the appropriate time. This is not the appropriate time to rebut and ask questions to a testifier. So I'll pass at this time.
So at this time, if you have questions that you had for invited testimony, please get those to our office. Remember, the invited testimony is not required to respond to questions that they deem not to. So please let us know. Are there any other closing comments? Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just two things. Number one, I want to reiterate something you said, Senator Reinbold. When the person, I'll step up next time myself. I'm going to object next time I hear somebody online, whether they're attacking me, you, or anybody else. I think, and thank you for at least stopping the prior testifier. It just isn't acceptable for those kinds of attacks to go forward, number one. Number two, I want to reiterate what you said earlier. In the past, you've left committee. You've left the hearing open, and it led to a lot of people expecting to testify. In that particular instance, which was a bill I was concerned about, you closed that testimony to send the message that the testimony was over, saying that you would open it if there was an opportunity. We adjourned at that time. It was toward the end of the session, so there wasn't an opportunity. You've indicated on the record that you intend to open public testimony again, and I think that you've made that clear to the people online and to the folks here in the committee, so let's be sure to enforce that and make it happen, and thank you for doing that. I really wish I had that opportunity for that bill many years ago, but that's the past. So thank you for being clear to the people listening online. And just to reiterate, please, Mr. Chairman and all of us, let's hold those who testify in a manner that is not becoming accountable. Thank you.
Yes, that's why we made those comments. Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I just want to thank all those because I can see the list that the chair has, and I know there are many private individuals. The bulk of the public testimony once it opened was people representing organizations, health-related organizations. And so I think it is important that we hear from Alaskans across the state, individuals, and what their wish is, because health organizations, of course, it fits under their umbrella, and it's probably positive for them. But I think we should hear from other Alaskans, and I encourage them, as the chair has recommended, to provide written testimony, but also verbally to try to join us again as the chair is able to open testimony, because I think it's vital that we hear from all of you as much as possible. I would also encourage members. The committee aide has provided written things that have been printed out for us, and take the time to look through those, read those. I did the other day with the packet that we were given, and there is definitely concern coming from around the state. So thank you.
Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was not able to ask a lot of questions. I keep being guaranteed over and over again that I'll get to ask my questions, but they're tightened down, limited. The administration is protected from answering a lot of the questions, so I find that very disingenuous. I will say that the person who was making odd accusations about me, I felt an opportunity that I should have the opportunity to clear the record. So, Senator Begich, thank you once again for listening and having a heart in regards to this. I was not able not only to ask any of the invited testimony questions, but I wasn't even able to set the record straight. And I think, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes after it happened is the inappropriate time. I will say that I do have a lot of questions that I've asked Ann Foyd, the Health and Social Services. They have not been very good answers, or they've been extremely incomplete or no answers at all. So I want to also thank everybody that's waiting online right now. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for calling in, for caring. I know that there's a lot of people that have been extremely negatively impacted by this disasters and by the disaster declaration and the mandates. And I want you to know that you have some allies on this committee, and we are not going to shut your voices out. So I'm going to offer an opportunity in judiciary for you to testify next week. I will be posting about that tonight. I want to hear your concerns on Senate Bill 56 and in anything in regards to the mandate. So if you were shut out today, you're going to have another opportunity. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And for the record, no one was shut out. We allow folks to testify. Testimony will be open again. And we are adjourned at 3:09 p.m.